the memo is released.
That is the linchpin there, is you have an FBI, senior FBI official saying, we wouldn't have been able to get this thing without the dossier.
How much of the president's wish list can Congress actually do?
There's not a lot of energy to do that. There's not a lot of bandwidth when you have these big issues staring down at you.
And how miserable is it to serve in Congress?
I totally get and understand where Congressman Gowdy is coming from.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. With Rachel Sutherland, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. The memo is out. Early this week, the House Intelligence Committee on a party line vote okayed the release of a classified 4-page memo. Republicans show clear bias at the FBI in abuse of a FISA court to get approval of surveillance of a figure associated with President Trump's campaign. President Trump Friday morning officially declassified the memo without any redactions and over the strong objections of his FBI director and the Justice Department. You can read it for yourself at FoxNews.com. So what were the bombshells and what does it mean for the Russia investigation? For that, I turn to Jake Gibson, our Justice Department producer. What does it tell us? What new have we learned?
Well, I mean, we've learned that some of what we suspected was going to be in the memo is true. This is a memo that's mostly about the way in which a FISA surveillance warrant was obtained on Carter Page, who was a one-time Trump campaign official.
He was a foreign policy advisor, right?
Exactly. And I think when they actually—
Sort of an unofficial advisor.
At one time, I think, actually a volunteer.
Okay.
But I think also had been described as someone who was, who knew people around there. Now, the question is, I think that what we're talking about in this time period here, he actually wasn't on the campaign anymore when they got this FISA warrant on him. However, the question here is, what was the role that the dossier played in them being able to get this FISA warrant? Because, as you, I'm sure, know, if the United States government turns its huge powers on you and decides it wants to surveil you, they can learn a lot about you pretty quickly. If you've got the NSA and other agencies tapping your phone and looking at your Gmail and doing whatever it is they do, I'm sure that's not very pleasant. And so this is what we're talking about here is a massive power, and whether or not that was obtained on the up and up, and what was the role that the Trump dossier had in that process.
All right, there's a lot to unpack, and we'll just sort of do it as we go along here.
Sure.
We're talking about a FISA warrant. This is the surveillance court. It's very secretive. This is basically the FBI saying, listen, we think that this person is associating in some way, communicating with a foreign government, with foreign agents. We want to know more about it. Is that basically what the FBI in this case was after?
Yeah, it seems that in this case they're pointing to the idea that he's a foreign agent, and we haven't seen the underlying documents here. Even though the information that we see here is now been declassified and was classified, the underlying documents, the stuff that they culled this from, is still very much classified. So we haven't seen what they brought to the FISA court. We don't know that it was just the dossier. And you know, if you watch cable, it could be just the dossier, or it could be the dossier was nothing. It's probably somewhere in between that they had some other information, but this dossier was part of it.
What can you tell us about the FISA process? How are these warrants obtained? There's basically an application, I assume, a pretty lengthy sort of brief, legal brief that you give the judge.
I think and you have to go before a judge and ask a judge, you know, and prove to a judge why you need this thing.
So there could be pushback from the judge who asks questions of, in this case, the FBI.
Indeed.
Okay.
And so the question is, you know, was this dossier, which was unverified salacious, all the rest, put together by Christopher Steele and Fusion GPS and Glenn Simpson. And we also learn in this document, not to jump too far ahead, that Bruce Orr is a big part of it. And we at Fox News did a lot of reporting about what was Bruce Orr up to and why had he been fired. This was a senior official at the Department of Justice.
So you've introduced a lot of characters. I want to sort of go one by one with them. Let's start with Carter Page, because all of this four-page memo basically surrounds the FISA application for Carter Page. Carter Page, as your reporting has suggested, was known to the FBI well before President Trump entered the campaign, right? He was not somebody who they learned about as a result of his work through the Trump campaign, was he?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Carter Page at one point was doing some business in Moscow. I think that we've seen reporting that he actually either lived or spent a lot of time in Moscow and did a lot of business deals there. And so, you know, that type of thing may land you, you know, with some people looking into what you're up to. And I think that that's what we learned about Carter Page, is that this is not the first time they had heard of him, and that he may have contacts with, you know, maybe the FBI was worried that he had contacts with senior government officials. And this was just, he was a red flag to them, I think, is what we see here.
And so the other reason I asked that question is because the way that this FISA warrant works is they're only good for 90 days, right?
And then you have to.
And then you have to reapply. So
exactly.
It's, we don't know if this, or do we, if this was an initial FISA request or if it was renewal over the course of a few of them.
We know that that according to this document, according to this memo, that the first time they got the FISA request and they obtained their FISA warrant, they did introduce the dossier. And they may have reintroduced it later. We also learn that, you know, as we saw today, I'm sure that you saw President Trump when he was asked about Rod Rosenstein, if he still had confidence in them, and He said, "What do you think?" And that seemed to get all the reporters a flutter about whether or not, you know, Rod Rosenstein is long for his job. What we learned in this memo is that Rod Rosenstein was one of the officials who signed off on a reauthorization of this FISA warrant on Carter Page the fourth time, the last time, and that has many people wondering, you know, what President Trump might think of that.
Okay, let's move on to Bruce Orr, who, as you say, was an associate deputy attorney general at that time. He is central to this memo because he had the relationship with Christopher Steele, the former British spy who put together this dossier, right?
Well, he had a relationship with Christopher Steele, who was instrumental to the dossier in the sense that he was the source. He produced a lot of the intelligence that went into this dossier. I think the other character who is instrumental in producing it is Glenn Simpson, who runs the Fusion GPS,
which financed this. Sort of hired Christopher Steele, right?
And let's remember that we are hearing from Republicans today that it was paid for by Hillary Clinton's campaign and the DNC, and that's accurate, but it's not the whole picture. That was first paid for by the Washington Free Beacon.
Okay.
They're the first one who plunked down some money on this thing. And then when they ran out, the DNC and Hillary Clinton came in. So it is accurate to say that they paid for it. But they're not the only ones who paid for what ultimately became the dossier. And Steele knows Orr. He knows him, we don't know how long, but I think they've known each other for a number of years. The same with Glenn Simpson.
So the key line from this memo is that in September of 2016, Christopher Steele admitted to Orr that he was desperate that Donald Trump not get elected, was passionate about him not being president. That, I suppose, then calls in the question the motivations of Christopher Steele, and does it call in the question then how many people at the FBI knew that there was this animus, this bias, and how they should handle the information? I guess what I'm asking you is, why is that a relevant fact to the broader memo?
Well, I think it's relevant some would say it's relevant because of exactly what you're talking about, some type of bias that he may have had against the president. And was that bias reflected in the production of the memo, in what is in the memo, these salacious details that we've heard about. And or we're told by this memo is that he worked closely with Deputy Attorney General Yates, who was under Obama, and then later Rosenstein. And shortly after the election, the FBI began interviewing Orr. So we know that Orr had spoken to, from our own reporting, had spoken to Steele and Simpson during and after the campaign. And then now we learn that what we suspected was that the FBI was interviewing Orr and documenting his communication with Steele. So Steele's still getting his information to the FBI, even after the FBI had cut off communication with him, because, according to this memo, he had committed the cardinal sin. He had told members of the media that he was talking to the FBI.
Okay, so this comes down then to what role that dossier played in obtaining the FISA warrant. Now, this memo would lead you to believe that it played a central role, that the FISA warrant, the authorization, would not have happened were it not for what was revealed from the dossier. Now, the flip side is we've heard from Democrats who have said that's not true, that one, the dossier did not play that big a role, and two, it was well known within the judicial process that there were some political biases. I guess the question then is, how important will it be to see this Democratic memo?
Well, I think we do need to see the Democratic memo to see what they've got. I think, as a reporter, we both want to see it.
We want to see the FISA application, right? Don't we? There's no chance we see that, right?
I would never say no chance, but I know that
those are usually highly classified.
Yeah, highly.
Because what it seems we're going to have now is this problem of he said, she said, over a very serious intelligence matter.
And also, if you look to your point, later on in the memo, we see another crucial line. Deputy FBI Director McCabe testified before the committee in December 2017 that no surveillance warrant would have been sought from the FISA court without the Steele dossier information. So that, for me, that is the linchpin there, is you have an FBI, senior FBI official saying, we wouldn't have been able to get this thing without the dossier. Now, the problem there is that, as you've said, there are Democrats out there who say, that's not true. We were in that closed-door session. That's not true, that line.
Yeah.
So I don't know how we get home.
I don't know how you reconcile that.
Right, exactly. And
so that's why there's just been so much ambiguity about all of this. I guess I would wrap this up, Jake, by just asking you this. Does this bring any clarity to the overall Russia investigation, or does this, with what we think will be a Democratic release of its own memo, just further sort of muddy the waters? And
if the aim of Devin Nunes was to use this memo to blow up Mueller's investigation, I don't think that will happen. I don't think that gets him there, and I don't think that gets President Trump there, if that's what he was hoping would happen here.
All right. Jake Gibson covers the Department of Justice for the Fox News Channel. Jake, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There are a lot of questions, but one thing is for sure. The controversy over this memo is not random. To put the release the memo hashtag in perspective, it's helpful to go back almost a full year when President Trump first tweeted shocking claims he'd been wiretapped, seemingly out of nowhere. He posted four tweets on March 4th, 2017. It was a Saturday morning, and the president was at Mar-a-Lago. At 6:45 a.m., he says, "Terrible. Just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism." It's important to note the memo does not contain any information to corroborate the president's claim that Trump Tower was bugged, but the tweets may have fueled Republican speculation and queries into possible spying, setting off the chain of events that led to the memo's release. At the time, the tweets spawned memes and set off a firestorm, fueled in part by laughter at the president on Twitter and the late-night shows.
Like, pretty soon, Trump is going to be covered in tinfoil going, "The government is spying on me. They're spying on me. But you are the government. I know, it goes all the way to the top."
And this tweet, this accusation, this tweet was sent at 6:35 a.m. Who wakes up that angry? As furious. Somebody give this guy a Xanax or a Bran Muffin.
Well, the morning after the wiretapping tweets, former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper was asked about the claims by Chuck Todd on NBC's Meet the Press.
The president's tweets yesterday, this idea that maybe President Obama ordered an illegal wiretap of his offices. If something like that happened, would this be something you would be aware of?
I would certainly hope so. I can say, obviously I can't speak officially anymore, but I will say that for the part of the national security apparatus that I oversaw as DNI, there was no such wiretap activity mounted against the president-elect at the time, or as a candidate, or against his campaign. I can't speak for other Title III mm-hmm. authorized entities in the government, or a state or local entity.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if the FBI, for instance, had a FISA court order of some sort for a surveillance, would that be information you would know or not know?
Yes.
You would be told this.
I would know that.
If there was a FISA court order
yes.
on something like this.
Something like this, absolutely.
And at this point, you can't confirm or deny whether that exists?
I can deny it.
There is no FISA court order?
Not to my knowledge.
Of anything at Trump Tower?
No.
Then on March 22nd, 2017, enter stage right, Republican Congressman Devin Nunes, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who over the past year has had an expanding role in the Trump spying drama. Nunes claimed he had seen alarming information indicating Trump advisors had been swept up in surveillance.
The House Intelligence Committee will thoroughly investigate surveillance and its subsequent dissemination to determine a few things here that I want to read off. Who was aware of it? Why it was not disclosed to Congress, who requested and authorized the additional unmasking, whether anyone directed the intelligence community to focus on Trump associates, and whether any laws, regulations, or procedures were violated.
The top Democrat on the committee, Adam Schiff, responded, accusing Congressman Nunes of being in the pocket of the White House.
I think it gravely concerning to the members of the committee that the chairman would receive information that is pertinent to the scope of our investigation, and instead of sharing that information with the committee, would share that information with the White House. The committee has still not received the intercepts or other information that the chairman was referring to, and therefore it is really impossible for us to evaluate any of the merits of what the chairman has said. But I can say this. The chairman will need to decide whether he is the chairman of an independent investigation into conduct, which includes allegations of potential coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians, or he is going to act as a surrogate of the White House, because he cannot do both.
Congressman Nunes said he had seen dozens of reports supporting his claim, which appeared to corroborate the president's accusation that the Obama administration had wiretapped Trump Tower. But he did not reveal senior White House officials had provided him with the information when he made a late-night trip to the White House. Nunes later recused himself from the Russia probe. This is the background for what led up to the memo. And with Democrats preparing a rebuttal memo, America will wait for the rest of the story.
Believe it or not, it was just a few days ago, Tuesday, that President Trump delivered his first State of the Union address, calling on bipartisanship to solve a lot of problems. The speech was met, not surprisingly, by a fairly partisan response. Republicans loved much of what they heard. Democrats spent much of the 80-minute speech sitting in silence. So how likely is it that anything the president wants to get done can get done? Let's talk about it with our senior Capitol Hill producer, Chad Pergram.
State of the Union, Tuesday night, the president, as his predecessors have done, laid out a pretty lengthy to-do list for Congress. We know the top issues, right? Immigration and infrastructure. Those are the things that we think probably are going to get the most attention from Congress this year.
Well, they have to keep the government open. That's a big one.
Thursday night.
Right, and what they're doing right now as we speak, you know, it's Groundhog Day, you know, here at the end of the week. They are basically proposing keeping the government open for 6 weeks from now. 6 weeks, and they announced this on Groundhog Day. You can't write this stuff, Jared. It's really amazing. And the fact that they're doing yet another interim spending bill, Groundhog Day. Bill Murray would be proud.
And it's important you point that out, because the idea on the last CR was, let's separate the DACA issue, the immigration issue, from the spending bill. That way, you know, we can focus on just the spending aspect with this promise that if the government's open, at the end of next week, we'll have votes, perhaps in a votorama type setting. I don't think there's a path yet in the Senate on an immigration bill.
Right. Yeah, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has said if the government is up and functioning, we'll have a freewheeling debate on immigration. Now, whether or not they can get anything out of the Senate, let alone then through the House of Representatives, which is going to be the harder body in this because there's this bipartisan group of 22 senators that's been meeting on a regular basis to try to come to some agreement. But you know what, Jared? You know what could headlong all this all of a sudden? The debt ceiling. They have to raise the debt ceiling. The Congressional Budget Office just this week said, no, we thought you could probably hold off until the end of March. Now they're telling us that we think it's the early part of March. So it's hard to see how that debate doesn't get melded together. You could see markets spiral out of control if they don't lift this. This is one of the most onerous votes that members of Congress take. And the fact that they have to do something about funding the government again, raise the debt ceiling, when you get to all these other issues, that becomes ancillary.
I think you've answered the next line of questioning I have with that answer, but it's this. The president in the State of the Union also laid out a bunch of other initiatives he'd like to see done. He talked about vocational training, increasing funding for vocational training. He talked about paid family leave. These aren't new ideas. There have been presidents that have talked about this in their State of the Union addresses. It usually gets a very raucous applause, both Republicans and Democrats. Why isn't that at the top of the list?
Because those aren't the big things, you know, and they get big applause lines. It's almost like this rote set of boxes that has to be checked off in every State of the Union address. They get bipartisan support. If you talk to Virginia Fox, who's the chairwoman of the Education and the Workforce Committee, Republican from North Carolina, she will not call it educational or vocational training. She will call it education. She says you train animals, you educate people. So, but regardless of the semantics here, there's not a lot of energy to do that. There's not a lot of bandwidth when you have these big issues staring down at you: debt ceiling, funding the government, nay, DACA, and immigration reform.
The president laid out his four planks for immigration reform. It's what we expected would be in that legislative framework that had come out a few days before the State of the Union. The president was audibly booed when he talked about the limits on legal immigration, when he talked about changing or capping what he calls chain migration, family reunification is what Democrats are calling it. That can't be a good sign, Chad, that there were boos.
Well, when you're back into this period of semantics, you know, chain migration, if you talk to Luis Gutierrez, the Democratic congressman from Illinois, who's one of the biggest advocates for getting a large immigration bill and dealing with a DACA fix, he will tell you that is buying into, you know, the language, the lingo of the right, the chain migration. He said, we want families to be together. He says, if you put families together, what that does is it presents stability. Do you just want people coming with one relative, or do you want an entire family? Do you not want entire, you know, familiar relations? And that's where Gutierrez was very critical of Tom Cotton, Republican senator of Arkansas, and David Perdue from Georgia. He said, you know, our view of immigration will just never align with theirs. And that's why this is so nettlesome and why it's so hard to get it done.
And why the debate matters. The language being used is what's being debated right now, even above the policy that may be being debated right now.
Right. And the president, one of the biggest applause lines, at least from the Republicans, he turned the Dreamer comment, the Dreamer language, you know, it's called the Dream Act that deals with these DACA recipients, around. He said, well, we Americans have Dreamers too, thus implying that there are regular good old-fashioned Americans in middle America, and they have dreams, and you have this other crowd of people who's come to the United States who are here, their legal status is in question, and they are getting all of the attention, where he's trying to address those folks. That's you look at those rhetorical flourishes, you don't see that sort of division very often in a State of the Union message. When you're taking that language and turning it. And so now, you know, you're getting into the semantics, and when you start to really get down to the nitty-gritty with that, that's very demonstrative of just how big the divides are, the chasms.
So one of the things that we have heard from Republicans, at least in recent days, is perhaps narrowing this DACA fix. The president wants to do these four things, the DACA fix and then the wall slash the $25 billion in funding for security, plus the chain migration, family reunification, plus the end of the visa lottery. There have been suggestions I have heard from senior Republicans that say maybe the best we can do right now is something narrower, just the border security in DACA. Does that seem to you like a workable solution?
That was where it seemed like it was a few weeks ago. So to actually have broadened the playing field and then contracted it again. I mean, John Cornyn, right before the government shut down about a week, he said, I thought we were going to do a DACA fix in exchange for some border security and call it a day. That was his language. Suddenly then, they kept talking about we have to narrow the issue. So everybody knows, and the administration keeps talking about these four pillars. Well, by getting down to the four pillars, they actually didn't narrow things down. That's the irony, Jared. They expanded it. And so maybe if they are going to get a deal, they have to go back down to what John Cornyn is about. But it was already demonstrated that that was a non-starter. I mean, the president basically nixed this idea. Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, was willing to give him a year of border funding in exchange for DACA, and the president said no.
I mean, there's the House problem with that as well, right?
Yes.
A much narrower sort of this for that border security DACA is probably not going to get the votes it would need in the House.
Right. And that's where, you're going to have to court Democrats. And if you are limiting the types of immigration eligibility and you're using terms like chain migration, you're not going to have a lot of happy Democrats who are going to be willing to vote for this either.
And we will see that play out presumably very soon, assuming the government doesn't shut down later this month, Chad.
We might be talking about that this time next week.
By this time next year, there really will be a new-look Congress, regardless of whether Democrats flip the House or Senate or Republicans hold control. That's because at least 41 Republican House members and 16 Democrats are not running for re-election. Most are retiring from politics. Others are seeking office elsewhere. The latest on that list was a surprise to many of us, House Oversight Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy, a conservative Republican from South Carolina who led the Benghazi investigation. Gowdy is not facing any sort of scandal. He's in his early 50s and represents a very safe Republican district. The retirement reminded me of another early departure, Jason Chaffetz, who also stepped down as head of the Oversight Committee. Chaffetz is now a Fox News contributor, so I got him on the phone and asked him this.
Is it that miserable being a member of Congress right now?
Look, I totally get and understand where Congressman Gowdy is coming from. I think it has more to do with he and I were very similar stations in life in that we loved we each loved our wife. We adore our kids, but we're also both becoming empty nesters. And it's hard to be in Congress and be away from home for so much. And I think the prospect of being away, close to probably 200 nights while your spouse that you love is home alone, that's a bit much. I think he also believes, as I do, that you get in, you serve, and you get out. And certainly in the position as oversight chair and what he's done on the Intel Committee, the Ethics Committee, the Judiciary Committee, he's been working hard, doing everything he can. But, after 8 years, that's a pretty good stint. You hand off the baton and let somebody else do it.
How much of this, and you can speak for yourself, I don't want you to have to speak for anybody else that's retiring, but, did you consider at all the likelihood, the probability, the possibility that Republicans aren't going to be in the majority in the House of Representatives next year?
No. I mean, look, when I left, we were clearly in the majority, and, I would have been for at least another year and a half, but I've been in the majority. I've been in the minority. It's an honor to serve, but you give it everything you've got, and then you pass the baton to somebody else. I think that's the way it should be. It's the way that Congressman Gowdy's going. I think if people are to read what Trey Gowdy wrote, that is the Trey Gowdy that I know. I don't think he's hiding anything. I just think he's laying it out there and explaining that, hey, I've done this. Now it's time for another chapter.
We saw a quote this week from Senator Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, upset about some of the attacks that he faced from the vice president. I think one of the lines in the statement put out by Senator Manchin was, this is why Washington sucks.
Yeah.
Is the toxicity worse now than it was when you and Congressman Gowdy, I guess you were in a little bit before he was, but has that worsened over time?
I think for the most part, most members get along just fine. I think we're seeing a degree of silliness and divisiveness that I didn't experience in the first 8 years. somehow the Democrats' heads are exploding that Donald Trump is the president out of the United States. And I know that wasn't part of their script, but the antics that I have seen from the Democrats is really disconcerting. I think it's unpatriotic. I don't think it's the spirit in which we're trying to do things. You got people in the State of the Union, you know, playing a video game on their phone. You've got people doing email while the president's speaking. You got members that are boycotting the speech. I mean, that doesn't do anything to draw us together.
What about the president's nicknames for members of Congress he doesn't like?
Yeah, well, I don't encourage that either. I don't think that's helpful. I mean, it's something that the president has used to help brand people. I don't think it's particularly helpful. You know, in a campaign, it's about subtraction, right? You try to eliminate your opponent and their arguments. But once you're in Congress, it's a game of addition. You got to build coalitions and bring people together. And if there's too much animosity, then you're not able to get things done. So it's by no means just a one-way street. But I think some of the things I saw when I sat on the floor of the State of the Union were very it was just amateur hour for some of those Democrats.
You've been out of Congress now, a few months? Is the grass greener?
It is. There's life after Congress, you know, and there's that saying, friends don't let friends run for Congress, because, look, it takes a toll. It's a tremendous honor. I can't believe I was able to do it for as long as I was able to do it. But for me, I got a little soured on it. My life was a little bit out of balance, and sometimes you have to recalibrate and put your family first. It's what we talk about, but then when you actually do it, you know, it's an important thing. And I like still having a voice. I still love the country and the issues, but I like the better balance. Yes.
How do you see the prospects for the Republican Party in November?
I think I see no blue wave. I see Republican prospects doing well. They passed that tax reform, which is critical, dismantled one of the most onerous parts of Obamacare in the individual mandate. The Democrats are flailing in that they lack national leadership. If they continue to put up Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer as the would-be leaders of a Congress that might change, I think that will be distasteful for a lot of independents. I don't think the Democrats have a message. They don't have a messenger, and they don't have a message. And that's problematic when you're turning the corner now into February.
So this narrative's not, you're not buying into this narrative at all, this blue wave, that a lot of these retirements are because members are facing tougher re-elections than they've ever faced before?
No, I think in some part, it's easier for somebody to run who has no record. Turnover is a good thing. You look at the Darrell Issa's seat in California, the Democrats are worried they're going to end up with two Republicans going into the general election in November. I think the way they have treated the president, walking out of him at the State of the Union, the flash poll on CBS with 75% approval of the president's message. I think there's a lot of distraction with some of the other tweets and whatnot. But what really matters to Americans? Things are going better than they have in a long, long time.
All right, Congressman, I'll let you get back to your family. I appreciate you taking some time, though.
It is easy to talk about Congress in the abstract, throw the bums out and such, viewing all of Washington through the lens of policy and not people. Wednesday morning, a chartered Amtrak train carrying a couple hundred Republican lawmakers, their staff members, and families en route to a West Virginia resort for a legislative retreat collided with a trash truck on a rural section of railroad outside Charlottesville, Virginia. A passenger in that truck, 28-year-old Christopher Foley, was killed. Two other people in the truck were hurt and in the immediate aftermath aided by first responders that included members of Congress. Congressman Tom Cole from Oklahoma described it this way to the New York Times. He said a group of lawmakers with medical backgrounds rushed to the train's exits, demanding Amtrak personnel let them off. Cole said they demanded, "Get me off this train. We weren't going to stop them." One of the passengers of the truck, whose injuries were described as critical, required CPR and received it. On the train, injuries were minor, mostly bumps and bruises, potential concussions. Speaker Ryan said afterwards,
"Well, I got to tell you, I'm just so thankful for the people who sprung into action today. I'm so thankful for the Capitol Police, the first responders, and to our physician members of Congress who sprang into action. Thank you so much.
In the last 7 years, two sitting members of Congress narrowly escaped death from the bullets of would-be assassins. Arizona Democrat Gabby Giffords ultimately resigned from Congress. Republican House Whip Steve Scalise, shot last year during baseball practice in Virginia, now moves around with crutches. These instances and others, I hope, serve to remind all of us who cover and closely follow the news here in Washington that passion over policy, competing visions for the future of this country, all well-intentioned and sincere, are only part of the people who make up the collective we call Congress. That will do it from the From Washington podcast this week. We could only be days away from another government shutdown. Congress has until Thursday night to pass a spending bill. The Senate expected to begin debate on DACA and other immigration issues, so it will be a busy upcoming week. There could also be additional memos and documents about the FISA and Russia investigations and responses from Justice Department officials. So between now and then, the best way to stay up to date is our top of the hour newscast right on your radio or anytime. I'm on the Fox News Radio app, Amazon's Alexa, Apple Siri, the Google Play. They'll all play our newscast for you. Just ask for Fox News or your favorite Fox News radio podcast, like this one from Washington or the Fox News Rundown. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.